CDC Director Nirav Shah with the latest on COVID-19 in Maine. If you look at any of the national maps tracking the status of COVID-19, you'll see that Maine is consistently one of the states doing the best, whether that metric is positivity rate, availability of tests, or rise or fall in cases. Maine is in an enviable position. But recent events show us that Maine is not immune from the virus, that one wedding in Millinocket can contribute to outbreaks at a long-term care facility, a jail in another county, and now a church. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with Dr. Shah about that case and others on college campuses in Maine. We'll discuss increased testing, vaccine development, contact tracing, and what public health experts are learning about the pandemic. Nirav Shah on Maine Calling next, but first, this news update. Hello, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For months, even as Maine's numbers have improved, Maine CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah has warned that COVID remains all around us and is still very contagious. Recent outbreaks in Maine illustrate his warning all too well. Well, today on Maine Calling, Dr. Shah is our guest. We will discuss these recent outbreaks as well as contact tracing, testing, vaccine development, and more. Dr. Shah, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Thank you so much for having me back, Jennifer.
And if you have questions for Dr. Shah, we already have dozens. Send it in soon. You can email a brief, please brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Dr. Shah, why don't we just start with the latest numbers? This is one of the days where you do give your press briefing at 2 o'clock after this program. What are you going to tell the people of Maine today?
So here's an early preview of where things stand right now in Maine. There are a total of 4,548 cases of COVID-19, which is an increase of 22 cases since yesterday. Sadly, 132 individuals with COVID-19 have passed away, which is about the same number as it's been for several days, and about 3,950 people have recovered. The number that we really focus a lot on as we're trying to get a sense of what the complexion and the contours of this pandemic are two things. The first is the positivity rate. And that's a number I think a lot of folks have become familiar with. And right now, the 7-day positivity rate in Maine is 0.60%, which is actually about the lowest it's ever been. The other number that we keep tabs on is how much testing are we doing in Maine? And right now, we are doing about 333 tests per 100,000 people. Just to put that number in context just a little bit, that is an 88% increase in the past 30 days and a 54% increase just in the past 10 days. So we've been steadily expanding testing since day one, and we're continuing to do that now on day 185.
Where are we in terms of how quick most tests are coming in? I know one of the goals is to have most of them in within 48 hours, but in reality, is it even more quick than that?
So in some cases, yes, but not in all cases. So in order for a test result to be received, the test result has to be taken. A specimen's got to be taken. It's got to be shipped to a laboratory. In some cases, our laboratory up here in Augusta. In some cases, national labs like Quest and LabCorp that have their facilities out of state. The lab's got to run the test, and then the results got to get back to the patient themselves. All of that can take sometimes 2 or 3 days. The part that we at the state within Maine CDC can control is how long does it take a sample to get tested from the moment it hits our front door. And there we try to do all of our COVID tests within 48 hours and get the results back to doctors so that they can be delivered. In some cases, as we've all heard a couple of weeks ago, that number grew a bit long as there were cases surging in the South and the West, but that number was really for national laboratories, not so much the Maine CDC lab.
Let's talk about the case of the outbreak that's really been making news over the last week, week and a half. First, we heard that there had been an outbreak surrounding a wedding in Millinocket, now finding out that that outbreak may be linked to several other outbreaks, not only near Millinocket, but also in York County, and possibly the connection of a pastor who is a pastor of a church in Sanford and also a pastor of a church in Millinocket and several others throughout the state. What do we know at this point? I understand it's under investigation, but a lot of reporting is coming out. What do you know right now?
So I'll go through the numbers first. And as you noted, this is still under investigation, so we're learning more and more every day. But as of right now, there are a total of 134 cases that have been associated with the wedding that occurred on August 7th in some way, shape, or form. About 56 of those cases were direct wedding guests or their immediate contacts. There have been about 12 cases in total associated with the nursing home, Maple Crest, in Madison. And then now almost close to four dozen now cases associated with the York County Jail. And what I mean by associated, what these other sites have found, which whether that be the nursing home or the jail, is that we've discovered that individuals who attended the wedding or were a close contact of someone who did attend the wedding went back into their workplaces, be it at the nursing home or at the jail, and exposed additional individuals there. This is really illustrative of the fact that this is an opportunistic virus. And the more opportunities that we give the virus to spread and do what viruses do, it is almost inevitable that there will be outbreaks of this sort. Outbreaks of this sort are unfortunately likely to happen when folks are crowded in dense places, especially if they're not wearing face coverings.
So contact tracing, I'm sure, is underway. All those who have been diagnosed or are close to those who have been diagnosed have been asked to quarantine, correct?
That is correct. So quarantine applies to any individual who has been found to be a close contact of a confirmed case. And the reason that we are aware of what is going on here, the reason I was just able to rattle through the numbers that I have and come up with sort of a picture of how all of these disparate sounding outbreaks are actually connected is because of the work of contact tracers at Maine CDC. We have a team of just about 100 people now here at the Maine CDC whose full-time job it is to be engaged in contact tracing efforts. And they are the reason we can piece the various parts of this puzzle all together.
Does that mean that everyone who attended Calvary Baptist Church in Sanford this past Sunday ought to be quarantining now because people there were exposed to the virus?
So with respect to Calvary Baptist Church in Sanford, it's not necessarily every single person. It's folks who were at specific events on specific days where we have confirmed that individuals who are positive attended either a service or vacation Bible school associated with that church. It's also not simply being in the same room as a person, but also being a close contact. So what we've started to do is work with the confirmed cases to get the names and addresses and names and phone numbers of those that they interacted with so that we can reach out to those folks and provide them the appropriate public health advice. But certainly, if you have been told by Maine CDC that you are a confirmed close contact of someone who's now tested positive for COVID, you should be in quarantine, not interacting with others. That's the best way to limit the spread of the virus.
Before we move on to other questions, I do want to go to one of the questions that came in on Facebook, which is related to this. Karen asks, I live in Sanford and have been proud of my community in the state for keeping our COVID-19 numbers down. I just finished reading the article on the MaineMonitor.org regarding Pastor Bell and his blatant disregard for safety in my community and others. My question is, what is the CDC going to do to stop this now? How many more need to be infected before the church is shut down?
Well, the Maine CDC doesn't have the authority to shut down churches, unfortunately. We work with licensed establishments like restaurants and hotels. But I think this is an example as well as an opportunity for all of us to make sure that we're all doing our part. I know that there is a strong desire to make sure that everyone's doing the right thing. I have that same desire. I think this is an opportunity for all of us to ask our friends and neighbors one simple question, which is, what do we owe to each other right now? And in the setting of a house of worship, where individuals are coming together for the purpose of fellowship, I think every single person of faith or not of faith in the state of Maine right now should be asking themselves and their family and their neighbors one question, which is, what do we owe each other? What can we do right now to keep our friends, family, and neighbors safe? In the setting of a situation like has been unfolding in Sanford, in addition to what's been unfolding at Calvary Baptist Church, I think those questions are especially pressing right now.
All right. Dr. Shaw, I want to move on by asking you about the outbreaks at college campuses in Maine. The numbers are indeed small compared to some of the national stories we've been reading about, some of the outbreaks at larger universities. But we have had cases at colleges and universities in Maine. Where do those stand?
So we have had, as you say, some cases, a handful of cases across different institutions of higher education in Maine. A handful at Bowdoin, some at Bates, one at Bates, a couple at Colby, and then several associated with the UMaine system. Most recently, some cases at the University of New England as well. What we've seen is two things. The first is that as young people resume college life or go to college, there is a high likelihood that students traveling to their college campus from all over the country, in many cases from states that are much higher prevalence than they are in Maine, can potentially bring COVID-19 with them as part of their travels. But the other thing we've seen in concert with that, and I really want to commend colleges and universities in Maine, we have seen incredibly robust systems of testing students before they arrive into Maine and then testing them on a frequent basis after they've arrived here. I think it's really notable and important, Jennifer, that virtually all of the cases, not all, but virtually all, of the cases that we've detected among college students in Maine have been because of this active effort to go out and search for cases rather than letting there be major outbreaks with dozens of kids who are sick. Colleges and universities have been proactive in helping Maine CDC go forth and find cases, which then, of course, allows us to put those students into isolation and limit the spread. COVID-19 is a risk on college campuses. We've seen outbreaks across the country. It is a pronounced risk. However, like with all risks in our lives, we can take steps now, given what we know about the science, to put measures into place to mitigate that risk.
All right, let's talk about younger students. Back to school week for much of Maine right now. All counties have a green designation, though that might change on Friday. You're going to reevaluate for, I understand, Penobscot and York counties. What do you feel? Let me ask it this way. Do you feel confident that schools in Maine have the same capabilities that you were just talking about with colleges and universities to mitigate the risk in such a meaningful way that it does not, that going back to school does not boost the spread of COVID-19 in the state?
I think there are opportunities to do so within schools, within secondary schools in Maine. And the reason I say that is that schools differ from college campuses in a couple of very meaningful and important ways from a public health perspective. First among them is that primary and, to a lesser extent, secondary schools have a better ability to control students' movements within the school building. Students can be in the same classroom, and they can be put into a cohort, essentially a bubble, where they're only interacting with a small group of students while they're in school. Teachers can be rotated through to minimize their exposure as well. Unlike on a college campus where being in class is only a very small part of the college experience. So there are opportunities for schools to put into place these so-called engineering controls to limit the likelihood that students would pass the infection onto themselves or to their teachers. That coupled with, thankfully, a low baseline number of cases across the state of Maine, I think places schools in Maine in a strong position, certainly relative to schools in Georgia, Florida, Texas, et cetera. We are taking a close look at the two counties that you mentioned, York and Penobscot, in light of events that have taken place there. And we, of course, are continually taking a look at the data for the other 14 counties as well. Right now, there is a favorable outlook, but that could very quickly change. Our pledge is that when that situation changes, we'll be making sure that we report that out to everybody so that schools can take action accordingly.
Dr. Shah, I'm going to go to a question from Betty Ann on Facebook. She writes, she's curious to hear your opinion of, this is from Christina. I've always gotten a flu shot and try to keep myself healthy during colder months. With all of the precautions most of the general public are taking to prevent the spread of COVID, like mask wearing and washing and sanitizing hands and surfaces, will this also help to curb the prevalence of other cold and flu viruses? How much more likely is it that someone will contract the common cold or flu versus COVID?
The answer is yes. The measures that we have all been asked to take, and many folks across Maine have been taking, physical distancing, wearing a face covering, those measures are protective not only against COVID, but also other respiratory viruses, namely influenza virus. So there is a twin benefit of taking measures like physical distancing and mask wearing. That's a good thing. But on the other side is we now have the possibility of the co-occurrence of both influenza and COVID-19. Both of these viruses weaken your immune system. That's what viruses do. And so there's the possibility that if you're not careful, you could wind up with not one, but two bad infections. So we are simultaneously bracing ourselves for sort of a twindemic of COVID-19 and influenza. But hope is not lost. One of the finest and surest things that you and your family can do to stay safe this winter is to make sure you get your flu shot as soon as it becomes available.
All right. Lori on Facebook says, what is Dr. Shah's response to CDC update yesterday that 94% of deaths died with COVID and other underlying conditions? How many of the COVID deaths here in Maine had COVID and underlying conditions?
Yes, I'm aware of that report that came out, and it doesn't quite capture what might be going on here. The first is that it wasn't a new piece of data. It was data that had been there. This was not a new or a revised analysis. But the other, and I think the more important thing, is that this is what viruses do. They open up the door for other conditions to come in and cause damage. So a virus, whether it is COVID-19, influenza, HIV, you name it, what they all do is lay the groundwork for other types of things to happen that can contribute to making people sick or, in the case of these data, make them pass away. So, for example, with COVID-19, the most immediate effect of COVID-19 is pneumonia, but there are other diseases that COVID-19 can precipitate. For example, things like respiratory distress syndrome or embolisms, or blood clots, a number of other things that viruses open the door for can happen. So we shouldn't take comfort in these data whatsoever. They do not diminish the seriousness or what I think I'm fair in saying is a significant mortality associated with COVID-19, anywhere from 0.6 to over 1% of people who acquire COVID-19 may become seriously ill and pass away.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Nirav Shah, head of Maine's CDC. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Museum LA with our Working Waterway, an exhibit funded in part by the Maine Bicentennial Commission, museumla.org.
Gym owners say they've gotten a bad reputation during the pandemic.
This fear-based propaganda that gyms are a cesspool of coronavirus, which is just super not true.
But public health experts maintain gyms are risky. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Can we work out safely during the COVID era? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, an inside look at the early years of the CIA from journalist Scott Anderson. In his new book, The Quiet Americans, he says the agency's covert operations to overthrow elected governments damaged the United States' moral standing after the defeat of Nazi Germany and earned the hatred of many in the developing world. Join us.
Coming up tonight at 8 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, we are talking with Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. If I can find my mouse, we will go to Tammy calling from Lewiston. Hi, Tammy. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Shah. I was wondering when we might see more rapid results testing sites in Maine. We often travel to Massachusetts and try to comply with the state requirements of testing before coming back to Maine, and currently waiting 2 to 3 days for results. We've tried to find rapid results testing locations in Maine and have had minimal success with that. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are.
Sure, that's a great question. You know, the rapid tests are starting to come and become more available on the market right now. Right now, however, many of them are being used in healthcare facilities to test patients who come into the ER, or in nursing homes to test residents who start developing symptoms. There are a few sites in Maine, however, one in York County and then a couple others that are scattered across the state, that are using the rapid tests to test folks such as you who come in and are looking to comply with Governor Mills's travel orders and can get a result in 15 or 20 minutes as opposed to a day or two. Those are going to become more common as the technology both develops and becomes more accurate, as well as becomes more available when the manufacturers start ramping that up. This type of rapid testing, testing folks on a daily basis or several times per week, similar to what colleges and universities are doing, is likely going to be more of a feature of how we all get back to life in the way that it was before COVID as the technology develops. Right now, there are a handful of sites that are doing it, and I expect that there will be more soon.
Tammy, thanks for your question. An email from Mark. Of the people who have recovered, that's in quotes, about what percent are fully back to normal versus experiencing long-term effects?
So in Maine, as well as across the country, there are a small percentage, anywhere from 5 to 7%, of individuals who have been deemed to be recovered by Maine CDC, but are still experiencing various after effects of the virus. They may still be fatigued. They may still have body aches. In some instances, those individuals can go on for a long period of time with those symptoms. But the numbers in Maine are about similar to what we've seen across the country. What's important to note is that even though individuals may continue to feel symptoms after they've been declared to be recovered, the likelihood of them transmitting the virus is very, very low. However, if the symptoms that they continue to have are respiratory symptoms, we may ask them to consult with an infectious disease expert or a lung expert just to see if there's something deeper going on. In many instances, sort of going back to what we were saying before, being infected with coronavirus can set off a chain of events that could precipitate other medical conditions as well. And so we would want to make sure that what's going on that's leading to those continual symptoms is not some other medical condition.
Dr. Shah, we have several questions coming in for you about high school sports. I'll go with this one from Dana that came in on Facebook. How concerned should we be with transmission as it pertains to student athletes, given the low number of deaths? Can we meet in the middle to play safely? Thank you for your support of sports and dedication to mitigate risk of this virus.
Well, that's a good question. And you know, the way that the email there ended, it is exactly right, which is it's about mitigating risk. So is playing sports a no risk or a zero risk activity right now? No. Was it ever a no risk or zero risk activity? Probably not. So the question right now, the task of public health officials, educators, coaches, parents, and the students themselves is to figure out how to go about playing those sports in a safe manner. I don't think any final decisions have been made around this because there is no such thing as one school sport. The risk varies greatly from sport to sport. Staggered starts with cross country are one thing, but football might be another. So I think the discussion right now, I think the best way that I can characterize it is that we're trying to figure out how those differences across sports, what that means for all the others, and what's the best way to go about approaching this issue in a way that balances the need and the psychological benefits of playing sports and being part of organized school activities with the simultaneous need to keep students safe. I don't think any final decisions have been reached, but there's a lot of conversation underway right now.
We'll go to Mary calling from Portland. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Dr. Shaw and Jennifer. My concern is the masking, and I think it's awesome, but there are so many people that won't mask, are wearing the mask incorrectly, or wearing just a shield with no mask. And I was recently in a grocery store that just opened in Westbrook, and on the outside it says occupancy 300, and I thought that was way above what it should be.
Dr. Shaw.
Sure. So I can't speak to the individual grocery store without, we'd want to know how large it is and such things. But with respect to the face covering usage, it's certainly, I think, improved, although it's clear that nationwide, statewide, we've got more of a ways to go. So let me mention two quick things. The first is something that's come into our office just in the past couple of days. Are questions regarding whether, if you're wearing a face covering, you do not need to maintain 6 feet of physical distancing? And the answer is no. It is not an either or, it's a both and. What we've found and what scientists have demonstrated is that it's the combination of maintaining physical distance in addition to wearing a face covering that really, really reduces COVID-19 transmission. Now, is that possible all the time, every moment of your life? No. We want to be pragmatic. But where possible, doing both as opposed to one or the other is strongly, strongly recommended. But the second thing is this with respect to wearing face coverings. There's a lot of talk out there about how long this COVID stuff is going to go on for. And when I talk to my colleagues and when we talk to scientists who model this stuff and look at the computer simulations, one of the things that comes up over and over again is that one of the surest ways to start bringing COVID-19 to its heels would be universal wearing of face coverings as well as physical distancing. If you've been on the fence about whether to wear a face covering when you go out, well, certainly it's part of a lot of Governor Mills' executive orders. So that in and of itself should be compelling. But the longer we go without wearing things like face coverings in places like grocery stores or at events, the longer COVID-19 is going to be with us. We've got the ability to control what the course of COVID-19 is in Maine. It's just up to us to make sure we get it done.
Thanks, Mary, for your question. An email from a different Mary. Could Dr. Shaw give an update on any progress toward effective treatments for the virus? All of the attention has been on potential vaccines, but no news about therapeutics.
Mary, great question. So right now, the mainstay of treatment for patients who need to be hospitalized remains a drug called remdesivir. It's a drug that's been available for quite some time and has been approved for COVID-19 for several months now. It's been in widespread use across Maine, particularly when individuals need to be in the hospital. It is effective at reducing the severity of the disease for those patients. There are also other treatments, some of which have been in the news lately, that have recently gotten FDA approval. The one I'm referring to is what's called convalescent plasma. This is utilizing plasma from individuals who have recovered from COVID-19 in the hopes that it can be given to other folks to help their body get a boost and do a better job fighting the virus. This methodology of using plasma for folks has been around for decades. It's not a new idea. Right now, it's just been given the green light by the U.S. FDA, although there was a fair amount of controversy surrounding that decision. But those right now, in addition to what's called supportive care, equipping the body to make sure it's got everything it needs to fight the virus itself, those are really the mainstays of treatment.
A tweet here from Frank. I don't know if you have any children, but if you do or did, would you send them to in-person school here in Maine?
You know, I think it would depend greatly on where in the state we were. However, in this situation, given what I have seen about the data in Maine, I would not have hesitations. If we had children, school-age children, I would not have hesitations with having them attend in-person education. However, that's just one guy's opinion. So I think it's also important that we recognize that there are other folks out there that don't share that opinion. And how we work with those parents to make sure that they feel safe, that there are mechanisms in place to keep their children safe in school, that's where the conversation is right now. That's, I think, something we've got to do more around. But right now, when I compare the data in Maine to the data that are coming out of other states, they're worlds apart. Certainly, if we were having this conversation in Florida or Georgia or other parts of the country right now, I would not feel that secure.
We'll go to Benita, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Benita. Go ahead.
Wait, hold on one second. I have to turn my speakerphone off. Am I there?
Yes. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Shaw and Jennifer. Thank you both. I recently had an antibody test, and it came back indeterminate. And I was just curious as to what that means or what that could possibly, and other than going back to be retested again, any thoughts on this?
Sure. You know, antibody testing is something that we haven't really talked about in a while. So antibody tests have become more reliable in the recent few months as the tests and the manufacturers of those tests have done better at making sure that the antibody test is homing in exactly on the COVID-19 virus and not on other potential viruses. That doesn't mean they're perfect, however. And in some cases, the test and the machine is not able to make a firm judgment call about whether you've got the antibodies or whether you don't. And so in those situations, the machine can spit out an indeterminate result. What that really means depends on when you think you might have been sick and what use you are going to put the test to. So I can't really say anything definitive about what that test might mean for you in your circumstance, and nor can I really say whether getting retested would yield a new or different result. But what I can say is that as the antibody tests have gotten better over the past few weeks, over the past few months, the number of those indeterminate tests results have gone down, and thus the utility of the antibody tests have gone up. We still don't know, however, ultimately, how long any kind of immunity from COVID-19 infection might last. It could be months. It could be years. And we won't know that until all the science comes in.
Benita, thanks so much for your question. A couple questions coming in about gyms and swimming pools. I'll start with this email from Chloe. Could you address the guidelines for lap swimming in swimming pools? Different pools seem to have different rules, but they all state that they're following CDC guidelines. And I'd like some clarity.
Yeah, well, that's a fair observation. So, you know, here's the bottom line with swimming. There are some factors that make swimming a safer activity. There are some that make it a riskier activity. Let's start with some of the protective factors. First is that swimming tends to be something that you're not in super close contact with. It's not the same as playing water polo. You're generally in a lane and you're several feet from others. And of course, for a large part of that time, when you're exhaling, you're not really near anyone at all. So that makes it a little bit more protective. On the other side, however, if you're in an indoor pool, there's still the likelihood when you're taking a break after a lap that you could be in close contact with someone and could be breathing pretty heavily, which are prime conditions to transmit COVID-19. So there is not a hard and fast rule with respect to swimming. I say all this because we got to recognize that swimming is an incredibly good physical activity, and it's really healthy to be doing. So I think the best thing to do is that if you're going to be swimming, try to maintain as much distance as possible. And if you're taking a break in between laps, try to do so on the off lap so you're not really kind of hanging over the rails with somebody who's right next to you and you're both breathing heavily. Basically, maintain as much physical distance as possible, both in the pool and when you're getting in, as well as when you're changing.
And Marianne on Facebook asks, please ask him if he would go to a gym.
You know, I'll be honest with you. When I tend to exercise, I usually tend to exercise outside. And so I'm not really a big gym goer, even pre-COVID. For me personally, one of the benefits of being in Maine is that there are pretty much gyms all around us naturally, whether it's going hiking or whether it's going to a field and working out there. To me, that's one of the most glorious aspects of Maine, is that there are natural gyms everywhere you turn and everywhere you look. So for me, my vote is to work out outside.
All right. We're talking with Dr. Nirav Shah of the Maine CDC. More questions when we come back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Marshall Communications, a proud sponsor of On This Day in Maine's History, heard daily on Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical, and Breakwater, inviting you to learn more about their outdoor learning spaces and plans for the school year. school.breakwaterlearning.org.
Maine humorist and author John Gould passed away on September 1, 2003. Born in Boston on October 22, 1908, his family moved to Freeport when he was 10. Gould began writing a weekly column for the Christian Science Monitor and wrote his first book in 1940. The Monitor syndicated his column and he was published in major magazines and newspapers across the United States. For 5 years, he did a daily radio show for WLAM in Lewiston and a weekly show for WBZ in Boston. He was also a frequent contributor of taped features for the Trans-Canada English Network of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine!
I'm Marco Werman. Other nations look to the U.S. and see us struggling to manage COVID-19.
I get emails and text messages from all over the world just kind of shaking their head. What is happening? Why has the U.S. response been so ineffective?
Looking at the U.S. from beyond our borders, we put America's Day in a global context. It's the world.
This afternoon at 3 o'clock on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. And today on our program, we're talking with Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah. We're going to go now to a call from Jake in Portland. Hi, Jake. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you to you, Jennifer, and to you, Dr. Shah. I had a quick question that's pretty straightforward. But before I even get to it, I just wanted to thank you, Dr. Shah, on behalf of myself, one citizen, who just appreciates the job you've been doing, your consistency, your clarity. I hope you get a plaque or a raise when all the smoke clears because you've been doing a tremendous job, and I really appreciate it. But my question is that I'm on the board of an organization here in Portland that is having an event. We have this every fall. It's the organization's the Maine Tool Library, and we have a cider pressing party every fall. And for the reasons you were talking about earlier with gyms, there's definitely psychological benefits to having this gathering. It's outdoors, we'd be wearing masks, but the board has been debating on whether or not to host this event. And I figured I might as well just call up the resident expert and get his take on it.
Well, first of all, Jake, really appreciate the kind words that you started with, and they are words that have been echoed by others. And I can't tell you how gratifying it is for a guy who moved here not too long ago, not really knowing what to expect other than beautiful scenery and great hiking. It means a lot to me, and I just want you and everyone to know that the reception that my family and I have received really does mean a lot. In terms of the event that you're hosting, you raise the right question. It's a balance. on one hand, we've got to keep events like this moving, especially in your case, and I'm familiar with your organization. It's an important fundraiser. On the other hand, we've also got to keep folks safe. So I don't want to comment specifically on your event. And so this isn't advice specific for you, Jake, but in general, these are the parameters that I would ask organizers of any kind of event, no matter the purpose of that event, to keep in mind. The first is if you can keep the event entirely outside, that's a great starting point. And by entirely, I really mean entirely. You can't have 60 people outside and 40 people inside or 100 people inside and say that they're two separate events, because we know people are going to commingle. You can keep the entire thing outside, you're off to a good start. The second thing is I would ask everyone to make sure you are abiding by Governor Mills' executive order, which in terms of outdoor gathering limits the size at 100 individuals flat out, including guests and other workers who might be there. So that's number two. The third thing is, to the extent you can make wearing face coverings the norm at the event, the better off you are. One of the best ways to do that is for the organizers and the board members and the planning committee. When other guests show up, they've already all got their masks on. You set the pace by demonstrating that this is the kind of event where masking is not just asked for but required. That helps you get a long way there. And then, of course, the last thing is we've talked about this, keeping it at a distance, meaning trying to space out the tables in such a wet manner that people aren't naturally congregated, really helps with that engineering piece behind the event to keep folks spread out. Those are the principles that I would ask anybody holding any kind of event, whether it's a fundraiser, a backyard barbecue, any kind of celebration, to bear in mind.
Jake, thanks so much for the question. I know many people share that. And I'm going to ask a follow-up, Dr. Shaw. My understanding from having you on the show before and from the reading I've been doing in preparation is that there really are very few, if any, known cases of transmission outdoors, correct?
There are some. I don't want to it's not none, but they are fewer. And the ones that have been documented outdoors have been in places where there have been close congregation with no mask wearing, water parks, things of that nature. There has been demonstrated transmission in settings like that. But what we know based on the data are, and this is from scientifically done studies, not just estimates, that the risk of transmitting COVID-19 in outdoor events versus indoor events is about 20 times lower. It's not 1,000 times lower. It's not zero. So being outdoors does not obviate the need to have a face covering on, to be physically distanced, but it does reduce the likelihood. What we're kind of dealing with as we go into these new phases of COVID is trying to do activities in manners that are safe. We're not going to be able to get the risk to zero, but we can reduce it. And being outdoors is a significant step toward reducing the risk.
All right. Lots of questions about Massachusetts and travel from Massachusetts. I'll go with Terry on Facebook. Terry writes, Maine is at 1.01 positivity, Massachusetts at 0.93. Why won't Governor Mills open Maine to Massachusetts residents without quarantine or COVID testing?
Well, let's start with the numbers. The numbers that were noted there are not accurate. Maine's positivity rate is 0.6%. And the positivity rate in Massachusetts is around 2%. In addition to things like positivity rates, we also look at just how many new cases they're having. And the number of new cases in Massachusetts is significantly higher, adjusted for population, than what we've got here in Maine, even with the latest big outbreaks. And then, of course, the third thing that we look at is not just the numbers, but some qualitative factors like the complexion of the outbreaks. And even there in Massachusetts, we're still seeing outbreaks among individuals who are in the same category that we might expect to be traveling. The same applies with Rhode Island as well. Our principle with looking at other states has always been we will look to admit other states without the quarantine or test requirement when those states have epidemiological profiles that are as good, if not better, than that in Maine. That does not mean those residents are not allowed to come here. We, of course, welcome them, but they've got to get a test before they come or they've got to quarantine.
All right, an email from Dennis. When is the best time to take a COVID-19 test after you've had a possible exposure?
Dennis, this is a great question. The answer is a little bit interesting. So the best time to take a test after you've got a confirmed exposure. So let's say you are at an event and you happen to be seated next to somebody, and either the main CDC calls you or that person even calls you and says, "Hey, Dennis, you know what? I just got a COVID positive test from my doctor. I'm just calling to let you know." And the event was last night or the day before. The best time to take the COVID test is approximately three to five, maybe 6 days after the exposure. It's not a hard science, but 3 to 6 days is about where you want to be. Some folks say 2 to 7, others say 4 to 7. But 3 to 6 is about where you want to be. The reason you don't want to take it too early is that the virus may not have had enough time to develop in your body. And so when you get tested, it may be negative, but if you would have waited a little longer, it would have been positive. So you also don't want to take it too late, because if you take it too late, you may have been exposing other people. So the best time is a couple of days after that exposure.
All right. We'll go to Charles, who's calling from Surrey. Hi, Charles. Go ahead.
Hi. I just like to know, and then I'm going to get right off the line, what happens if you get flu and COVID at the same time?
Well, Charles, good question. We really, when COVID emerged back in February, March, we were toward the tail end of the flu season. We were still in it, but there weren't significant numbers. This year will be the first time where scientists will have had an opportunity to study the co-occurrence of influenza with COVID-19. What we know based on those two viruses, though, is that the co-occurrence of them is unlikely to be good, especially if you've already got pre-existing or chronic illnesses. How bad it's going to be, exactly how deadly that combination might be, no one's quite sure yet, but suffice it to say that the concurrence of those two is not going to be something that anyone's going to want, especially given our older than average population in Maine. We're particularly concerned about this. I know I've already said it on this program, but please, as soon as your healthcare provider or pharmacy has the flu shot, please make plans to go get it.
All right. We've got a series of questions. Our producer is calling the "What would Dr. Shaw do?" questions. Here's another one. Please ask Dr. Shaw if he personally gets takeout food.
Yes, I do, and it is delicious. But I also love cooking with my family, and that is something that we've enjoyed doing more and more during this pandemic.
All right. We'll go to Lori, who's calling from Sabattis. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Dr. Shaw. Thank you for taking my call and doing all of this good work to get words out here. My thing today that I would like to talk about is, in some cases, it feels like our loved ones that are in congregate settings, in my particular case, it's memory care, that we are guarding them from COVID-19 so much that it feels that it's detrimental to everyone involved. To physical and mental health beyond the idea and the risk of COVID. For instance, I'm allowed to take my mother to doctor's appointments and be at the ER with her at her worst, but I'm not allowed to have a 15-minute outdoor visit with her on her good days or, yet in another facility 5 minutes down the road. You're not allowed to go to the doctor's, but you're allowed to have 15-minute visits outside. Of course, all is proper precautions and all the questions and all of that. It seems like there's nothing consistent across the board. And speaking with the professionals that work in these environments, that depression rates for loved ones are skyrocketing. How can we?
Lori, I'm going to let Dr. Shaw answer because we've got so many questions. Go ahead, Dr. Shaw.
So, Lori, you raise a good concern. It's one that I am very much in tune with, and I'm with you. As with so much in this world of COVID now, it's about a balance. We saw, of course, early on the heavy toll that individuals and loved ones in long-term care facilities, nursing homes, memory care centers, the toll they experienced as a result of COVID. And that, of course, has informed our desire to keep them safe. And we all share that desire. But we've got to balance that with their need to socialize and meet with family members who can not only provide a social outlet, but an advocacy outlet from a healthcare perspective. Lori, I would ask that you check in with the folks who operate your mother's memory care, because outdoor visits should be allowed. And there are also plans in place to get facilities on a track where indoor visits, more social visits, can be allowed. I don't think we're there yet from an epidemiology perspective, but there are plans in place and markers that will help us get there right now.
All right. Lori, thank you so much for your question. A question here from Brad. I would like to know, as a state and a country, what is our ultimate end game goal when it comes to COVID so we may get back to a somewhat normal society again? And I think this reflects a lot of questions. Early on, Dr. Shah, we were talking a lot about flattening the curve and making sure that our hospitals were not overwhelmed. Does that remain the goal, or is there a different goal now?
So that is and has continued to be one of our primary goals, is to make sure we can keep case numbers at a place where when we, for example, get into flu season, we are not overwhelming intensive care units and ventilators, things of that nature. We've done an admirable job of that in Maine. However, I think as everyone will recall, not too long ago, just a couple of weeks ago in Florida, there was talk of hospitals starting to run out of ventilators and ICU beds. So that does remain a goal. The other goal remains keeping the most vulnerable safe. By most vulnerable, I'm referring not just to the elderly, but those with chronic conditions, both of which occur in high percentages in Maine. So that's one of our other goals. And then the third, of course, is to start resuming activities of daily life like schools, colleges, universities, gyms, going out to eat in manners that are safe. We still are learning about what the best mechanisms to do that are, but that's one of the primary goals right now.
Dr. Shah, so many calls and emails coming in that we're not going to get to. Is there some place people can go with their questions if they aren't able to ask you directly on Maine Calling?
So, you know, yes and no. Yes, insofar as for data on what's going on in Maine, as well as FAQs about how to go about a lot of the things we've talked about, travel, where to get tested. A lot of that is on the Maine CDC website or Governor Mills' COVID-19 website. Very tactical, very granular information about I'm in Piscataquis County and I want to know where I can get tested. That's where the answers for those questions are. But more generally, I think it's important for everyone to keep tabs on what's going on with COVID-19 via reputable sources. And for that, I would recommend folks go either to the U.S. CDC or to the World Health Organization's websites for the latest on the scientific information and the epidemiological information about what's going on with COVID.
Well, Dr. Shah, thank you so much for joining us today. I know that you're going to be back shortly to offer your regular briefing. Nirav Shah, the director of Maine's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Also joining Dr. Shah at his regular briefing in just a few minutes will be Department of Health and Human Services Commissioner Jean Lambrew. So stay tuned to Maine Public Radio, television, the web, or Facebook. Sandra Harris ran the board today, and today's program will be rebroadcast at 7 this evening. You can find past editions of the program at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.